Hey, it's JD here. And
your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit InsureKidsNow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
And you're probably tired of podcasts asking you for money. I get it, so I'm not going to ask. I am, however, going to strongly suggest, with love, that you give me money.
This isn't about exclusive perks or gated content, though those exist. It's about supporting something you believe in.
If you've been enjoying the Tragically Hip Top 40 Countdown, if it's made you laugh, think, feel something, or reconnect with a band that means the world to you, this is your chance to give back.
I make this show because I love the hip, I love this community, and I believe in telling stories that matter. But it all takes time, energy, and of course, your support.
By joining the membership, you're not just helping to keep the show running, you're also helping to raise money for the ALS Society of Canada.
No minimum. No catch, no problem. buymeacoffee.com/TTH Top 40. Membership. Support the show. Support the cause. Support what you love.
A member of the DATC media family.
Previously on the Tragically Hip Top 40 Countdown.
Mike, your song is Fiddler's Green. This is a tragic song. What are your thoughts?
Well, that song, geez, tearing up just hearing it. But Gord's lyrics in that song are like next level poignant. And combined with that music, it's so moving, right? Like, did you know, JD, that the term Fiddler's Green is one used by sailors to describe an afterlife? Did you know that?
I did know that because I've had three other Tragically Hip podcasts, but I did forget till you reminded me. Hey, it's JD here, and welcome back to the Tragically Hip Top 40 Countdown. It's my pleasure to be here with you every Monday as we spend some time sharing stories and experiences while counting down 40 essential songs by the hip that you chose with your very own top 20 ballots. I simply tabulated the results using an abacus and a ceramic bust of an unknown televangelist, eyes painted shut with what appeared to be correction fluid. He wore a spiderweb crown and a crooked smile, the kind that promised salvation or multi-level marketing. I guess I'll never know. How have your favorite songs fared in the rankings? Let me know at tthtop40@gmail.com. This week, I'm joined by a very special guest. This is Pete from Toronto, and we're going to get into why he's a special guest, but I'll probably give it away by telling you his title. He is a music video and commercial director, and it is my pleasure to be here with him today. How the hell are you doing on this heptastic day, Pete, from Toronto?
I am so stoked to be here. So thrilled. My legacy with the hip is a long time running. And but it wasn't for a long time that I thought about it until the great Doc came out, and that sort of rekindled and kickstarted a hard drive in my heart, and all those old memories and reflections sort of came rushing forward, and this opportunity is a perfect complement to that.
What I really love about that is that the feelings that came rushing back are so positive. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they're charged with emotion, but they're so positive that you do want to talk about it. You know, like some people I know are still so, I'm going to use a word that I don't mean to use, but damaged, you know, because of because the band has stopped being and Gord stopped being. And it just is really nice to hear somebody who's looking back with fondness and reverence and is ready to celebrate. So cool.
Well, it had been years since the band and I had had any contact of any kind, short of special gigs, and I could get in if I brought a can of food. When I heard the news of the diagnosis, definitely I reached out and got an answer back immediately, a lovely little note, and that's all I couldn't believe that he got back to me so quickly, because it had been years. And then he passed, and then there was seriously 6 months to a year of fond grief. Like, it really was golden memories of a lovely guy, and complicated, but that was half his allure. And I thought about him a lot, and it sort of faded gently until the doc came out. And again, that was filtered through a prism of time and distance and music that had much more music that had come since I'd worked with them. So that was what I was mired in while basking in it. It's been a very gentle process.
Yeah. Well, I've got to talk to a lot of people, and everybody has processed it, as you would surmise, very differently. And, we'll get into that a little bit more as we get into your history. But let's do that right now. We've let the cat out of the bag. You've worked with the band in the past. But let's hit a stop on that and rewind even further to where you found them or discovered them or heard them the first time. Where was that, and what was that like?
I had a keen interest in music videos in film school and paid very close attention to Much Music and MTV when it was available. And from the time I got to film school, from 84 to about 87, I was like, where's this Canadian sound going? They were emulating the Brits and the Americans beautifully, and we had our megawatts, you know, Adams, Hart, Dion, all of them were sort of cutting through. But then it was getting like, ooh, I don't know, man. I don't hear our voice anywhere. And then sort of mid-87, you know, bands like, you know, Chalk Circle, Blue Rodeo, Pursuit of Happiness, 5440, Northern Pikes,
yeah,
Engines, all these guys came out. But pulling away from that pack, and I was pretty stoked at how great the music was and how great the videos were. And but then all of a sudden, this Small Town Bring Down video came out, and I was like, who the fuck is this guy? Like, I mean, and the whole band, who's the whole band? And who's this guy kind of leading the charge, who seems so beyond the music, abundantly aware of his visual presence and his ability to work with a camera. I don't know if you can recall his sort of throbbing metronomic sort of action.
Absolutely.
And it was like completely captivating. So it's like, mental note. Who's that? The tragically hip. Okay, whatever. We'll see if they last. And then Last American Exit. And you're going, this is solid, and this is kind of right in the fold with the bands I mentioned before. And it felt like there was a wave now, but the preeminent drive of that was the hip. So I kept very close attention to them, based on singles that were on Much Music and Q107. But I wasn't devout enough to purchase the music until I ended up editing music videos at a production company called Revolver Films. And then you pay doubly close attention to what's going on around you in your industry and your craft. But then the hip started, as far as I was concerned, just kind of slipping video wise. Like, the music is great, but I'm not sure about these visuals. But I didn't think much of it. I didn't realize that there would ever be a chance to write that ship.
from there, what was it that prompted you to put that $8.93 down, or $10.83 down, because it was 99 cents in tax, or $9.99 in tax for a cassette? When did you plunk that down and pick up your first record?
Well, it would have, the CD, I never got vinyl. The CD would I guess Road Apples, I had, you know, and then Road Apples. Then I love Road Apples so much, I doubled back onto Up to Here.
Ah.
Caught up in that vein, and was just, you know, when you go, wow, that was better than the last song, which was better than the song before that, which is like, this is, I'm drowning. Like the water's rising too fast around me. I'm just gonna try to breathe through my eyes here because it was coming too fast.
This fucking music's sinking and I don't want to swim.
You know what? It occurred to me as I was talking, I was like, oh God, it's too close to sinking. Don't say sinking. So.
So from there you get that record, and at what point do you get to see the guys live? Is that once you start working with them, or did you see them live prior to that?
I was very selective with my concert dollar, and this takes a little rewind. At Revolver, sure, Films, the CBC had, because they were primarily a music video, the preeminent music video company, I think, in the city/country, and CBC approached them to do a documentary on this up and coming band. So they've just, I think, Road Apples is out and it's got its momentum, and they're doing those nights at the Forum, like six nights in a row or something, massive sellouts every single night. And so they've got a lot of heat. The CBC decides we got to do something about these guys. And they contract Don Allen, my boss at the time, to generate a concert film. But in amongst at Fort Henry in 1991.
This is Full-Fledged Vanity.
Full-Fledged Vanity, yeah. And
I know this.
And I roll my partner, creative partner, and this is what's important to note from this story on. I will refer to us and we. His name is Sean Valentini. We went to film school and basically ended up at Revolver together at the same time. And we were creative partners, him wanting to be a cinematographer, me wanting to be a director. But at that point, lines get blurred and you just bandy about ideas together. And then you become the director of record and the DP of record. But I was editing and a shit editor at Revolver, like average on my very best days, when Sean goes, Don needs to, he needs a crew to go with the hip through almost every major market in Florida, and then Boston, and New York, and New Orleans. And it was, I think I can get you on a sound. And I'm going, but I have baseball finals that week. Like I was that close to bailing on this opportunity. And then he goes, you pull your head out of your ass and let's figure this out. Baseball will be around next year. And I was like, okay. And so I was going to be the sound recordist on this Tragically Hip documentary with like $50 a day per diem, with very little exposure to the deeper cuts and the deeper hip philosophies and everything. I'm just a solid fan. And then we fly to New Orleans. It's so funny. My young brother-in-law at the time, he's my ex-brother-in-law now. He was 14 and ravenous, carnivorous fan. And he's going, so tell me, where'd you meet the band? And I went like, oh, we were just in the lobby in this crappy New Orleans hotel. And this guy comes towards us, friendly enough. And he goes, are you guys the guys? And I go, I don't know. Are you the guy? And he goes, I'm Gordon. I go, I'm Pete. And Sean introduces himself. And it's amazing from that moment on. And my brother-in-law goes, okay, wait a second. So you met Gord Downie in New Orleans. I went, yeah. Okay, great. It still isn't clicking for me. And then we had that night was the first time I saw them singing six songs, opening up for Eric Johnson, this amazing blues guitarist. Six songs, not their audience, so they could take chances and do sort of more not outlandish, but brazen performing without their brand weighing them down. And I was like, holy fuck, these guys are out of control. Like six songs they won me over. This is an opening act. And then they played, of course, New Orleans is Sinking, and my brother-in-law goes, wait, let's wind back there. So you met Gord in New Orleans and saw him perform New Orleans is Sinking in New Orleans. I go, hey, yeah, you're right. Who knew? Crazy, huh? And then it was from there, it was to Tallahassee and then down all through Florida. where you become fast friends. And as a as an opening act, they didn't have an entourage or really even their management around them. So slowly but surely, and Gord referred to us as sort of the gorillas in the mist. You sort of approach the band a foot a day, and but before you know it, the band doesn't even realize that they've embraced you and brought you in. And we had our own rental car, so they would just kick the shit out of each other to drive with us because it was air conditioned and comfortable, and they were so sick of their fucking van, the R9. So they were all like, "We don't want to go with those guys. I want to go with those guys." And everyone took turns, and it was a great time. And what an indoctrination into what a great group of guys these are before you get into their music, before you get into their any collaboration or any videos. It was a beautiful, it was a, kind of a beautiful thing. And they were just like me. They were, we could joke about the exact same things, time references, cultural references, that was nothing went flat. And, it was really perfect. And then we had to go back to Toronto and caught up with them again in New York, then again in Boston and Chicago. And, we were happier to see each other every time. Again, away from their families, we were kind of these weird step family, the two of us sort of landing into their circle. And they were like, "Get in here." So it was amazing.
Very welcoming.
Beyond welcoming. It was such a, it's not like we needed each other. Like we were, Sean and I were very sort of open to our next opportunity, and we weren't soliciting or jockeying for any sort of position in their realm. We were just happy to be working on this documentary. And
of course,
years later, 9 years later, we there was a film, Almost Famous, Cameron Crowe, about the young reporter following Stillwater, the fictional band. And I go, "Sean, have you seen this fucking thing? It's us through Florida and the East Coast for like 6 weeks, because we couldn't get the interview with Gord. Like all the other guys always kind of brushed us off and fluffed it, and it was, but they always kind of came around, "Okay, let's do this. But Gord was the missing interview. We'd gotten everybody else for hours, and then one day he, like, we're very close to the end of the Florida leg when he goes, I'm in a mood. You want to go right now?" He sort of points to his watch, and we're like, "Holy shit," because it's kind of sundown in probably not Tallahassee, but sort of Miami or Fort Lauderdale. And Sean looks to me and goes, "I think the beach is the best place to shoot him because we have no time to light anything. He's given us 40 minutes and it's going to be dark. And so where's the most light? On the beach." But there's barely enough light. And it was the hand of God that touched this interview, because I think Gord, without light, without people around on a beach with the sounds and just the three of us, was conducive to an even better mood, a more honest mood. Not that I asked anything too probing. It was like, "Tell me about the name. Tell me about your beginnings." You know, nothing that groundbreaking. But he embraced it like it was the first time it had been asked. There was no condescension, no eye rolling. He took it very seriously, and I deeply appreciated that. And Sean, with his exposure and his framing, made it seem like Casablanca. It was black and white palm trees in silhouette. Gord is almost in complete silhouette, but there's just enough information bouncing off the sand to make, just give you enough detail. And when you see that documentary, and subsequently it was used in the big one, it really is lightning in a bottle. It was, because I know, because he, for 3 weeks, he would not talk to us. I don't feel like it. Not in the mood. Don't want to. Never a dick, but just was sort of shruggy.
Yeah.
And there we were. We had 2.5 rolls, which equals about 17 minutes. And he used it all up, and we went for a couple of beers after that in the hotel bar. And we had it, you know? It was great.
Oh.
And it was a relief, and
you
huge
knew
it. Relief.
You got the feeling. You got the feeling you knew you had it.
Because he answered it with a certain mythos, where you'd know he had answered these questions before. But he gave it our own personal spin, based on the context of the beach and sunset and dusk and quiet. And it was I hate to use words like intimate, but it was proximate. We were like feet from each other because the surf was making too much noise and I had to ride levels and the whole bit. It's from here to eternity. What can I say? We rolled around in the sand as the surf surrounded us. Anyways, no, it was the perfect way to capture that. And then we got the whole band and then spent months and months cutting. I can tell you, like, Gord went to the next level when he decided with time down after just before shooting or recording fully completely to with that 8 months of time, he wanted to join in on the post-production of this documentary. He it's not like he distrusted people handling it, but he just wanted to know what was going on. Like, I think he was very into the visual aspect of the band, and I think had kind of quietly taken the reins on all that. And the guys were like, yeah, run with it, Gord. And to the point where he eventually started directing videos himself. Good ones.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So that's interesting to think that you were there on the ground floor of him learning some of this stuff, showing interest in and absorbing some of that stuff. It just shows the kind of creator he was, you know?
Yeah, very creative, very creative. I wouldn't call it, we were almost exactly the same age, and I wouldn't call it intimidating, but you hear these lyrics and you can't help but grant him fucking everything. Like, I mean, your opinion means everything because of the work I listen to and how I see you on stage. I grant you everything, Gord. Like, you're right, probably, most of the time.
Yeah. It's just somebody who's got a job and he's really, really, really fucking good at that job.
The best. The
and
best.
It's almost like, it's a, yeah.
And almost has contempt for himself. Like, it was adulation and if it was off stage, he did not like the attention. He didn't like the clamoring. He didn't like the screaming from cars. As we walked to work, because he actually lived quite close by to cut the documentary, he appreciated this kind of, I have this weird background route where no one really sees me. It's alleyways and middle of baseball diamonds, and there's no way a car can really. And he apparently like wore a groove in that route too.
And I can almost picture it, because I saw him at the Danforth Music Hall once, and he came up through an indirect way, and I was like, I wonder if he's got a secret way or something. I have no idea.
Full Goodfellas. He knew the back way in, and that's the way he got to Revolver almost every day, through Bellwoods, back alley of Adelaide, all the way to Richmond. It was like, he didn't need Queens. He didn't need Bathurst, because this stuff, he too recognizable, too vulnerable, too out there.
So what's next in the journey? At this point, you are now a believer. You're getting in on this music, and you're getting in to this music in a way that is unique from anybody else that I've talked to. And that's really cool. I'm wondering if that relationship deepened before you worked with them again, or if it just deepened during that editing process, or where did it take a turn?
It was never lost on Sean or me that our perch was beyond unique and privileged. It was quite literally like, I met Gord and we were instantly collaborating on filming him and interviewing him and following him around and watching some major tensions in this band, like just personal interactions and dynamics. Nothing that would be out of the ordinary, but very private things, you know. And and we were privy to that. Mom was the word, and we didn't talk shit about it to anybody. And again, it was nothing incendiary. Just. Seven guys in the fucking van. Someone's gonna fart, and everyone's gonna be pissed off. And but they seem to come together at the end of every show. And through the editing process, the band was kind of doing their thing in Kingston, because at that point Gord and maybe Paul were in Toronto, but Gord was like minutes from the edit suite. And some days we wouldn't even edit. We'd just hang out. We'd go for a drink or just like watch other music videos that were being produced or had been produced. 5440 was making several videos of great directors at Revolver, Curtis Weyfritz and Floria and Sigismondi. These are the major people, in Don Allen. And so Gord was taking that all in too, the competition seeing what they were up to, and realized that the music videos they had done up to that point were whether that was New Orleans a Sinkin or Blow It High Dough or Little Bones. These were great songs with kind of, I don't think, with just misguided visuals and slightly lacking in focus and theme. A lot of visual trickery. And I could see Gord taking in everybody's videos. Everybody, Blue Rodeo was producing out of there, and I guess 13 Engines and Pursuit. They were all making videos at the same time, and Gord was, he wasn't freaking out, but you could see the wheels turning, and that it was kind of his responsibility to, again, right the ship visually. That's because, wow. And he wasn't anxious, but he was, again, focused, concentrated, and quietly determined. I didn't know him well enough to realize that he was in, as he referred to it, he went into full bloom and full brood, and he was in full brood for the last weeks of this documentary, especially as it wound up, because it was going to be released like Thanksgiving weekend of 92. And for all of September, he seemed like he was pre-mourning its airing, you know, like he was, like, yeah. He was almost detaching from Sean and me. And it was like, oh, I guess, you know, that's it for now. We're done
hanging out with rock stars.
I think our time has come, for which I was thankful.
But it hadn't.
Well, I have to rewind even just a few weeks after that, because a few weeks prior, it was the Albertville Olympics France in 92, the beginning of 92, Albertville. I remember that. They lit the flame by firing an arrow like 300 meters away. Some expert archer fired an arrow that went into the torch and set it ablaze. And I'm like, as torch lightings go, that was a good one. And then ring, 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 the phone happened. The phone rings, and it's Gord. Hey, it's Gord. How you doing? Yeah. Oh, Gord. Hey, yeah, cool. We're still kind of in the winding down stages of the documentary, which at this point was in an hour long thing, would be about a 48 minute show, and about 37 minutes of it was music, edited music. We cut down songs because we had to, and then interstitially placed our documentary sequences into the doc. So that was all kind of winding down. Gord's phoning up during the Olympics and says, he said, we want three videos all in the same tone, but not the same. I'm going to adopt a character for all three videos, and it's going to be linked together just in how askew it is. And that's how I ended up doing with Sean all three videos from that album.
Oh, that's fucking cool, man. And that is honestly, I'm not saying this because you're here, but that is the first record where the visuals start to match the sonic output, you know.
I've heard that record, not us, because Gord was huge in this. I can't emphasize that enough. He was with us the whole time, but he didn't want to get mired in production. But it was he needed this to change. He saw what was going on around him at Revolver Films and knew he couldn't, you know, just lay something out there that sort of was flat, and that he had to commit to it too. All these other videos had him like in milk and his hair in front of his eyes. He, I think, really wanted to open up his face and let us get a good look at him.
Yeah. And you really do. It's not like the other videos where he's obscured or the band is obscured or, you know, something like that. I'm curious, Pete from Toronto.
What did the record come?
Yeah. And the record label was like, there's something at stake here. Like, this record is their Rubber Soul. This record is their Revolver. They're changing their sound, and we cannot make a light rotation video that goes, oh, well, song's great. It needed to land. And we felt that, but we felt completely capable of doing it. And it was our chance. And as it turns out, 35 years later, I kind of owe my entire career to that triumvirate of videos that turned out really well. And Sean and I collaborated and frankly co-directed. And he's immersed his legacy in their visual dictionary. Like he goes back to the documentary into those three videos and then subsequent videos with several other directors deep into their catalog. So Sean and shot a bit of stuff for the doc too. And so because he's got his sort of hands in their visual directory that goes way back and right up to the moment.
Fuck, that is so oh man, I don't want to drop two fucks in the same sentence. That is really cool, Pete from Toronto. What do you say we park the car here, get out, and unveil the song of the week and get into the meat of this music video triumvirate, as you put it? How do you feel about that, my friend?
Standing by, sir.
All right, we'll be right back after this.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Hey, it's JD here. And having spent a career in customer service, one of the first things that I tend to do when I'm getting ready to work with a company or buy from a company, I check out their customer experience. This was certainly one of the things I did as I vetted North Star Bets during the beginning of our relationship. I've got to tell you, what I learned through this process is against the grain. They don't use bots, AI. It's a real-life person that you get to talk to 24/7. That's not 24 minutes, 7 hours out of every day. That's 24/7, as in all the flippin' time. Kablammo! How do you like them apples? Listen, this is a big deal. For North Star Bets, though, this is just business as usual. Filling out a bet slip. Visit northstarbets.ca. North Star Bets is licensed by iGaming Ontario. Must be 19 plus and in Ontario to play. Please gamble responsibly.
Hey, this is Paul Langlois from the Tragically Hip saying hello. Now on with the countdown.
Chronologically fucked up. Pretend by
Okay, there we are with song number 8, Locked in the Trunk of a Car. And we are thrilled to be joined by Pete from Toronto. And he is going to take us through this song in a way that we haven't really got to explore in this process so far, because Pete and his partner Sean actually made the video for Locked in the Trunk of a Car. It was one of the 3 videos that they produced for this record. And we're going to talk about it now. So Pete, at what point did you get to hear Locked and begin this project?
Well, being aware that, again, the suggestion was made prior to the documentary being finished that they'd like to get us onto this this album in this context. The trapdoor, the trapdoor can fall open. There's hotter directors than us, more accomplished directors than we are, and the Hip are about to hit as hard as they ever had with the release of a record. As near as I could tell, this one was highly anticipated. But Sean and I spent the next few months knowing that this might not happen, even though Gord would be behind it, but maybe some label would say no. But we definitely started to generate imagery for Locked. Again, Gord had, it was important for us to understand that Locked in the Trunk of a Car, dumping the body is not about murder or killing, or it was more about ending a relationship and how you handle that breakup and the emotional toll. And so we could delve into darker imagery. We had to be careful because Silence of the Lambs had just won the Academy Award for Best Picture months earlier than the video. But we also didn't mind kind of surfing that too. It's like, well, you know, the grizzly is hot right now. You know, the macabre is in style. And we set about shooting some fairly bleak imagery, knowing that Gord would be standing, the Gord and the band as the performance element would be standing in front of collections. And this is an idea Sean presented to me based on another video I submitted for earlier. He goes, remember that idea you had? I thought maybe it could work for that. I'm going, collections of birds and fish. And there was a third thing, like maybe it's two birds. Remember the panels behind the band as they're playing? It's collections. It was about the void in a heart that generates the need to collect stuff. And Gord was, he could get behind that. And then it was just about this mysterious guy who you see at the front of the video in the trunk. There's a sonic introduction of tick-a-tick, 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 which is obviously the hazards going inside the trunk. And this guy's got his hands tied, but he does manage to somehow light a cigarette. And then maybe this is his last smoke. We don't know. And then mysteriously, he ends up being the perpetrator as well, or the mystery man walking about, who happened to be Dave Powell, the band's road manager, who fully embraced.
I didn't know that.
That was Dave. And he was right into it. He didn't mind being scary or intimidating or threatening, whatever it took. And the band loved that too. They kind of laughed at it. And then that imagery just started to pile up, like, okay, the rings on the rearview mirror with all these possessions, are those from relationships or are they from murder? Like, you can see this, a collection. We see that he's in his duct and it's rotted. Yeah, it was a grain elevator in the middle of this field in Vulcan, Alberta, where the baseball diamond was and all this stuff, all these empty roads, free to shoot. You just rolled up to these locations without permission and just shot. And if anyone did have an issue, hey, what are you doing here? Shooting something for the Tragically Hip. You want to use my house? You 12 guys need to use my shitter? Because like, it was cinematic immunity when you mentioned the Hip. So we got free reign of Vulcan. Like we could just shoot anywhere. Cops were passing us by going, go ahead. We go into general stores going, can we shoot in your garage? Yeah, go ahead. It was a real country feel. And the old man was like, maybe you could fill up some gas. It was the gas station shot in Locked. And it was the old guy in front of his gas pump And he goes, it would help if you'd fill up. And so we filled up a couple of vehicles, I think. And he can close. He can close early now. Can we go into your shed and shoot through that window? Because it was so art directed with chains and gears and rusted metal as the car's approaching through the window. It was like serendipitous how just one thing presented itself after another. And it felt kind of guided by some other. Because at one point, Sean was worried he had overexposed the film, but we fixed that later in the process. And there was, and it looked even better. The grain in the black and white kind of sizzles on the screen because Sean had to push the processing and pull the transfer. Like there's a whole process of getting that image, but people asked him for years, how did you get that look, that the classic grain that everybody's always looking for. And he got it. And we started, and that was 3 days of shooting, tiring, long days because we went into some nights and pulled an all-nighter in the grain elevator and shot a bunch of stuff that didn't end up in the video. Because do you want me to jump ahead to the editing of it? Because
sure, you can take us everywhere.
Well, we shot the video. We were crashed at Sean's parents' place because they lived in Calgary. So like it never had a hotel feel. It never had a production feel. It felt very homespun. And we got all this stuff one shot at a time, 1 foot in front of the other. Never look at the mountain, my mom used to say. Just look at your feet making progress. And so we were just getting it. We're doing it. We're getting it. We're doing it. And we get back to Toronto and we start editing. And Sean actually ended up cutting this video because I think he was afraid any of the other editors at Revolver would just fuck it up. Fuck up my face. And then we got it to a place that we really liked and showed it to the band. And they kind of had a bit of a panic attack because some of the imagery was quite, wouldn't call it grisly, but so macabre as to be off-putting. And
sure.
And they were going, we're kind of hitting shit on the nose here. And Sean and I were like, huh. And we got momentarily got our knickers in a knot, but then went, okay, well, this is just the reality of it. Like this ain't flying the way it is. So how can we do it? So we took out a lot of the more, wouldn't call it gratuitous, but some of the stuff they took issue with, and replaced it with incredible performance stuff. Everyone looks amazing. Johnny had just, he was sort of experimenting with longer hair, but he has to reconcile the curls and stuff. And then he gets the single, and I said, that is a perfect haircut, Johnny. And he goes like, what do you think of black turtleneck? You mean your assassin look? I fucking love it. And everybody kind of took that lead and just sort of, I don't know if you seen them perform in this video compared to they are wide open. But Paul Langlois drops his head, which is great. I thought he was like one of the gruesomes from the Flintstones. Like I'm Slash right now. I know that sounds all very derivative, but his choice was to be a little more anonymous where he's often, cigarette dangling and kind of up front. He just sort of chose to drop his head and everyone else kind of lifted their chin to the light and kind of opened themselves up. They say that Roger Daltrey was sort of suffering in The Who until he opened his arms to the crowd. And then all of a sudden Pete Townsend says he found the voice of the band. And I think the band found their image right then on that day in October of 92, where you don't look cool by trying to look cool. You look cool by presenting yourself and sharing yourself and being vulnerable. And, Sinclair is just kind of rocking his hips to this thing. It's oddly sexual. Robbie's kind of crouched and kind of contorted. And that's kind of there's some sort of menace to that because he seems kind of like just bound up. And then Gord decides, at one point he goes, what shirt should I wear? And then Sean blurts out that red tattered one that I, in the documentary, saw for 8,000 interviews. He has a red tattered turtleneck where the sleeves are too long, and he would play with the cuffs and do this thing that was so hypnotic that I just said, we won't get better, but we can get more if we shoot another. And Gord took on a new improvisation every time, finger snapping between beats, and we actually added, you have to listen very closely, we added finger snaps to the soundtrack. And then they were really worried about this opening in the trunk.
Yeah.
Because they thought it imposed an initial meaning before you even hear the song.
That's right.
But once you see it, it's so dark and ambiguous, but I think it's a car, and the sound design is so nightmarishly sparse and metal. That they were, no, it's a tone setter. It's not a narrative guide here. And then it, once we took out those parts they had an issue with, it, and they had to wrap their head around themselves in the video. I think there were, I kind of got the feeling that they, the fact they look so good, was something they're going to have to contend with going forth. We're going to have to look good now.
You've now sort of set the template for what, you know, not to be pejorative, but what a good music video looks like for this band.
And branding, and as an ad, they were so behind their hair for four videos that you had no clue. And now they were presenting themselves, and it was again, as a director, when people are immersing themselves and you don't have to draw it from them, ask them to, you know, dive deep into their emotional experience. No, they just, we're going to lift our chins. It was that easy. We're going to let you see our faces. And Robbie has an especially good sense of the camera and angles and where he is. And everybody started to pick up on all that because everyone was shot as a single. No one was ever together. And everyone was watching everybody's performance, and it turned into a bit of a competition. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, if he can go there, so can I. I owe it to the band. I owe it to this video. I owe it to our visual progression.
And really, I feel bad now for saying the first videos aren't good. They're growing, right? They started in 87, and you're working with them in a mere 5 years later, and in that 5 years, they've lit the world on fire, or the Canadian portion of it at the very least. And you get to be there to, like I say, sort of set the template for what things are going to be going forward. And that's pretty special. That's pretty cool.
I felt that way. And they knew they had to pay off what they looked like.
Yeah.
Again, their hair was such a thing for all those videos. Everyone was just a mop or a long hair. And it was just like everybody was kind of hidden. And this time they're stepping out. And it was Sean and I would look at each other, like, you know, the sort of quiet, and we just giggled to each other. And then the video was released and I think Much Music was really, come on, be good. We want to get behind you, but you got to give us a good video. You got. And it was what they call the buzz clip that week, the hot new video that week in terms of the Tuesday release, which was when they added new stuff and took stuff off and ranked it and gave it certain rotations. And this was a buzz clip heavy rotation. And Sean and I were off and running, like catapulted, getting calls from other bands now. But we were single-mindedly focused on the next videos.
Because you had been given this triumvirate.
Yeah. And felt like there was no point in building momentum. Let's hit it hard. And we did. Yay. And how do we keep it going without being desperate to keep it going?
Right.
And it went through many, you know, the Courage and Huns Meridian, they went through their own issues and what that took. And Gord would not lean on locking the trunk of a car when it came time for Courage. And when it came time for 100th Meridian, he had a whole other character. I want to be a tourist now. I want to be on a rocky boundary as a tourist, witnessing and photographing. And that's why he bought this trench coat and luggage. And I was like, That's amazing, man. I'm going to take full credit for that, Gord. I hope you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and we hung Dave upside that manager who had played the antagonist in Locked was now the guy who sets off the fire extinguisher in Courage, and now the guy we hang upside down in a straitjacket in 100th Meridian. And these are, and when you actually inventorize the imagery from all three videos, I think this is tonally akin, you know? I think this flows nicely from one to another, black and white into color, into black and white again.
I was just going to say that the play with color palettes, even the two black and whites are different black and whites. One is like 8mm sort of, you know, Family Vacation style look anyway, that's not what it was. But then the other one is, like you say, so dark, and the color palette is really blacks and darks. And
you're absolutely right. Locked was about contrast and shadow, whereas 100th Meridian was more or less a daytime exterior thing, though we did shoot into the late evenings because you never don't shoot dusk and sunset because you have to. But that added finality to the 100th Meridian video. So that and then it was kind of by mid 93, it was kind of sweetly over. Sean and I were on our own trajectory, and the hip were about to, you know, day for night in 94. And that becomes, Rubber Soul Revolver transition sure from that. And their sound becomes much more ethereal and still rocking, but experimental and sultry and sonic and less four on the floor, even though I go back to those records almost more than fully complete those big three, you know, Day for Night, Fully, and Hen House, and sometimes you just want to eat soup. Just want soup. Enough of this hybrid fusion thing. Just give me soup. But yeah, no, and with every record, you just go, I was there. And look at these videos now. Look at their making. Gord had to phone me up and break up with me. He had to dump the body because he wanted to evolve. He knew that for his sake, the band's sake, that if they sat back and rested with the same team, that would generate its own aggravations and expectations and stuff that he wasn't interested in. And frankly, I was thrilled to go beyond one. So he sat me down at his place, kind of explained, and I just said, well, we're going to play street hockey still, right? Because we actually did that in the neighborhood, played a few games of street hockey. And some guy went, I just play street hockey with Gord Downey. And he said, we hung out, and we did hang out, but lives took over, and his career went this way, and mine went that way, and babies and children, and when we did see each other, very sweet, very nice, but much more seldom. But never did he leave my heart.
What an impactful, like, what would that be, like 36 months in total?
I would say,
like, from
September of 91 to March of 93, so almost 2 years. Let's call it 18 months, yeah? No, wait, 91 to 96, yeah, almost 2 years.
We need the abacus.
Yes, get me the abacus, monkey. The monkey agrees, around 18 months. And completely immersed in that, and then you had to start working on other people's music videos with knowing it's never going to be the first again, and it's never going to be that, because coming off of music, off a documentary where you get to know people, and they're bringing it into their video process too. They know us and trust us. Maybe like us, maybe don't like us that much. Sometimes you got mixed mess, but there was that history infused into the music videos, where most music videos you meet the band, go hi, you present your ideas, they go for it, but they know nothing of you, whereas we got this amazing specific introduction into our relationship with him professionally and personally. It was the stuff of dreams, you know.
I can't believe you were there, like, you know, shooting Gord as he's talking about playing Goonie Golf in sunny Pensacola, you know.
We were desperate. It's like, I didn't have, what question do you ask that's serious while they're playing Goonie Golf or racing go-karts or on the beach or playing tennis and stuff? It was not conducive to being revelatory. But when you did get them alone, quiet, usually after a gig or before a gig is when they're in their kind of zone still. And sometimes we woke them up after nights of partying. And to describe partying in Florida was the seven of us in a hotel room. There were hardly like dancing girls and cocaine on mirrors. There was nothing. There was no party. It was just us all hanging out. I remember
beer, smoking some joints, whatever, right?
A little bit of that, drinking some beer, cracking some jokes. And we were all watching Thelma and Louise one night in Florida. And there's this long shot where Thelma's gone in to rob the store because she's messed up and let Brad Pitt steal her money. And there's Susan Sarandon just sitting in the convertible looking at this old woman through a screen door as the sun's setting. So her face is kind of a little bit blocked, and it's a really slow shot. And I said, say it now. These are the kind of videos you guys should be making. And it was Paul who went, totally, you know, oh, for sure. Because it was so thoughtful and it wasn't, it evoked so much. And then we ended up making stuff in that vein. And that was a seminal moment too. Hope I'm not jumping back and forth too much, but this stuff.
No.
Has since No Dress Rehearsal, which is so good.
It's very good, isn't it?
I was so moved. And to be in the theater for the premiere is to watch people watch stuff for 4 hours with a little bit of a break? Motionless. The people on either side of me, motionless. Coughs. Somebody coughing would piss you off because you were leaning so forward into this.
Oh, I was there.
Yeah. Wasn't that great? Man. And I go, Hey, there's me. And just as a moment, like on the beach, you can just panning off of me as I'm holding this microphone and the recording device and headphones on. And you go, that's right. And then the honor of at the end of this, Gord's played his last show and we've reverted 30 years earlier to backstage, and he asks, "So Pete, you got any questions?" And I'm like, "What do you ask a guy who's just come off stage? How'd it go?" I've been mocked for how unprobing it is, but it was. I kind of, you know, when Billy Elliot's father sees him fly across the dance floor of Swan Lake, and your breath is taken away. That was kind of like it, kind of choked me up. And then the whole thing's over, and he's gone. But there we were. It was surreal isn't a good enough word. It was transportive. And my son said, "Are you proud?" And I go, "No, not proud. I'm just so happy to have been there. Just so honored and happy." And Sean feels the same way. And we talk about it routinely. And when Gord died, we just texted each other with the word fuck. And got together that night and raised one to him, but like thousands of people did. It was so sad. And it really, the fact that it was fall reminded me of the weather that we had worked with him the first time. So there was and Introduce Yourself I was listening to a lot. And it transported me and very evocative.
Yeah, I almost use the word surreal, but it was such a strange day. I was sitting in my coffee shop doing what I did every day, just sitting there working away in a notebook, and I got a notification, and that's what it was, and holy shit. We knew it was coming, but we didn't know it was coming, you know?
And you sort of deal with the diagnosis, and then you sort of deal with the tour, and you kind of say, okay, just give me a minute here. And then inevitably he goes, and That's the, and that you realize it wasn't just him dying. It was the lead up to that. That was months and months, and it was a better part of a year almost. It was about the same amount of time I worked with them, 18 months between the diagnosis and his passing. And it was in the same weather. And I remember walking my dog in the crispness, and I just would wonder what he was doing. You know, I know that sounds stupid. Like, wonder where he is. And I thought to myself, would you rather be gored as a hero at knowing that you'd die? No, I think he wanted every second. It was not satisfying enough to know that he was lauded and a bunch of shit was going to be named after him after you're gone. Who, you want to see the stuff that's being named after you, you know?
Agreed.
There's going to be libraries and schools and things in central Ontario and elsewhere, but he doesn't get to experience it. Other people have to break the bottle, you know, have to smash the champagne. But I think about him all the time. And I think about the whole band too, and Dave Powell and the management and like the whole experience, the record company, everyone was, it was a really forward moving ship. But as episode 3 reveals, you know, cracks form, but I was more or less, out of their realm at that point, but that seemed inevitable too. Think about who has this story, really. The episode 1, we're babies. Episode 2, we're teenagers, young men on a meteoric rise. Episode 3, inevitable cracks. And episode 4, you know, somebody dies. I mean, that's, you couldn't write that shit. And before
he dies, he goes on a cross-Canadian tour with his 4 brothers, and they tear it up. And today is the 9-year anniversary, actually, of the last show.
I watched with Sean alone. We were going to go to a bar with people, and we go, let's just watch it alone with our families.
That's a cool choice.
It was, that was his call, and I go, well done. And, you know, it's when they start kissing before the show, the little kiss goodbyes, I was, okay. Give it together. Yeah. This is real. This is so real, because it was all, I didn't do any of the shows for that last tour, and watching it was almost more than I could bear. But also a beautiful thing. You know?
So beautiful that we got to experience it and that they got to experience it like one last time. Like knowing.
How did Robbie refer to it? They landed the balloon. We landed the balloon.
Yeah.
And it was like, that's a perfect way to score. What a ride. And then touches down. And then there's a whole other thing that goes with someone dying, but the performance, it was so poetic. Anyways, wow. I'm digging deep here. That's pretty original.
No, but I think there is some poetry to this, and there's also some interesting, an interesting appendices to this story, a sort of a bookend to this story in a way with Get Back Again. Is that something that you would want to talk about or?
My son?
Yeah.
Yeah. My,
like how cool, we're beating around the bush here, but like here we are, well, 30 years later.
And my son, an aspiring filmmaker, very talented, but new. Had the gumption to work with Jake in coming up with, like, we don't have a lot of money and we're going to leave it in your hands. I think the band was fairly hands off and I was totally hands off. Just drove him to a camera rental place one time. That was the extent of it. And he comes back with a really gentle video, which I think was important, especially on the release of this song. And I, you know, there, you know, you don't say I might have done, you just go, that was really something. And you point out what is so great about it. And I was very proud of him because I had zero to do with it. In fact, he ambushed me with the surprise and he just happened. It was serendipitous how he got to meet Jake. But Jake said, I like the cut of your jib and you want to give this a shot, Cleve. Who can't even clean his room, had some sort of proposal treatment written within a couple of days. And Jake and the band are like, go for it. And I love Jake for not tapping into that PR. That could have been an easy spin in terms of promotion, father and son, you know. But
absolutely, yeah.
And Jake was very elegant, very elegant, yeah. in how that was presented. And I was so used to the song and the video, that when at the end of the doc, I go, "So how was it?" He goes, "It was awesome." The song kicks in, so I'm kind of reeling from hearing my voice 30 or 35 years earlier, and my name mentioned to me, and then the song kicks in that I've associated so closely with my son that I was a zombie walking out of the theater that day.
I bet.
And to be full transparency, it was my son who was beside me who was leaning into this documentary. And every time he saw me, he just nudged me, like the elbow. Yeah, I saw you. So, and it was only in episode 1 and 2, what a way to kind of wrap that up. I don't know. I doubt there'll be much more produced about the hip or their, how could you improve on that narrative arc? It's done. And they all did a great job. And the band was amazing about how they handled press and performing and how they've held themselves since Gord's passing. And I admire them so deeply, especially for how honest and forthright they were during the doc, because you forget that they're the guys who are kind of hit the most, you know? It's all like, no, I remember Gore when I was, you know, at camp or at the cottage. But these guys are going, no, I remember this guy in school. That's my void. That's how much of my heart has been cut open. So, and sometimes when you think of it, and then you see the four of them on stage with Jake and Mike and then Trudeau, whatever. And I took a picture of it that it kind of grainy and shitty, but I'm not going to discard it because it's everyone who needs to be involved. It's great. I was I was an upper balcony, and there felt like there was some kind of arcing going on between us. And again, they probably maybe wouldn't recognize me in a lineup right now because it's been that long and we've changed so much. But yeah, it's easy to recall. It's easy to recall, and it's great to have these visuals and these pieces to cue me like home movies of memories, you know?
That's beautiful. That's really beautiful. I think back to the 90s, and our memories are so often tied to photographs and how few photographs I took in the 90s. And I just wonder if I'd have a better definition of my own lived experience if I had taken a few more photos. But it just wasn't a priority at the time. So I try to now. I just went to Pittsburgh yesterday and I went out for a big walk in the morning and just took, I didn't look at anything as I took it. I just shot and just shot and shot and shot. And then on the ride home, I purged, right? I just got rid of the stuff that I didn't like, but I had all these memories captured, and it was really sort of powerful. So I want to thank you for creating those memories and magic for a myriad of hip fans with that trio of videos that you produced. I mean, the iconic Courage Boston Bruins sweater, his look as he's faking, you know, a cigarette smoke in Locked. There's just so much great visual memory captured in those videos. And you know, I was the perfect age. I was in 1994, I was 20 years old. So I was 18 when those videos broke, and probably a bit more critical than I had been earlier, because I had seen more videos at that point. You know, I didn't watch a lot of videos, and those were impactful. And I really want to thank you for, you know, being part of that. So, and coming here and talking. Pete from Toronto, is there anything that you're working on right now that you want to, knowing that this is coming out on Monday, is there anything that you want to plug or share?
I am routinely shooting commercials for a living. I have a personal project that I'm little thing, but it's not worth really noting. It's going to be shown once for the neighborhood, and it's kind of all my powers and all my skills to make people in my neighborhood laugh at a neighborhood film festival. But you know what? Whether it's a hip video or a funny little 10-minute more or less sketch, it's your heart and it's everything. And I'm as nervous about this thing coming up on just after Labor Day as I was heading to Calgary to shoot a music video with a preeminent band. Like, I was riding their coattails for sure.
Well, you know, you got to blaze a trail on those coattails, so that's pretty fucking cool.
Yes, I appreciate them. I appreciate this opportunity because it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. And you required me to remember, not conjure. And I had to really, is that the way it happened? Is that the way it happened? Yes, yes, that's the way it happened. Because legends take off and become reality, and I didn't want to distort. It was as just dudes meeting dudes, and we just did it, you know? It was great.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, thank you so much. I'm thrilled that you were able to come by today and we were able to lock this up.
Lock this thanks. Up. I see what you did there.
I did that not on purpose. Oh, I wish I should. Oh,
that's
I'm going to edit
that's
that.
What makes it goal. That's what that took courage.
Huh?
On that note.
Well played. All right, Pete from Toronto.
JD.
And everybody listening, thank you so much. We'll see you October 4th at the event. Pick up your shit.
Thanks for listening to the Tragically Hip Top 40 Countdown. To email us, send an email to tthtop40@gmail.com. We're social. Find us on all the socials at tthtop40.
Tubra! Podcasts and such.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.